relying solely on the generosity of our community to donate their time, money, and instruments to keep this amazing service alive. Find us at www.joesmill.org or Joe's Mill on Facebook for more information on borrowing instruments or contributing to Joe's Mill.
You are tuned in to Kingston's only truly local radio station, CFRC 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca.
It's 7 o'clock and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM. We're broadcasting from Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. And this continuation of the Aboriginal Voices radio program.
And Sean, I'm glad you started that way, because people need to know the top of the hour and what hour we're in. So, and you know, here at CFRC.
So they know it won't be much longer.
That too. But we're here till 8 o'clock. But it also means that that we have 24 hours a day of radio broadcasting. Not
isn't you, that nice?
Not you and me, but the station.
Oh gosh, no! I don't think anybody should be subjected to that.
We did that years ago. I don't know. Now that you say that, do you remember back when we did we did 24 hours about homelessness?
I do remember that. I did not attend.
Mm. It was February.
I think you did, though, right?
Yes, yeah. Well, I went to help set up, to get it set up after my work that afternoon. But it was minus 22 outside in downtown Kingston when we started. But it was actually in conjunction with many of the campus and community radio stations right across the country.
Yeah, they don't do that anymore.
I'm not sure.
Or maybe they do. We just don't participate.
But anyway, I was just reminded of that, and looking at all those things that happened way back, where people were pointing out that some things about homelessness don't mean that these people should be left to to die in the cold. It doesn't matter where in the country. And having us try to broadcast from outside in the cold, it gave us equipment problems, too. It wasn't just people who were upset. I think some of the equipment decided, it's too cold. I don't want to play. But anyway. But Aboriginal Voices, we've been doing Aboriginal Voices since September 1994, every week. And I'm really amazed to be able to say that you and I have had the opportunity of being friends for that long.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, 32 years. That's a lot. So
long time, Doug.
And you have brought many bits of laughter to the show. So thank you for that. First, we're going to have some of the new music from Mike Byrne. Mike Byrne is from New Brunswick, and this is his newest album that he's put out. And so we played one song in the first hour, and I'm going to play two, one from a previous CD and one from this new one. Give you a taste of Mike Byrne's writing and his ideas, and then we'll come back and we'll go to that piece that I mentioned. A little bit more music later on, and then we have another chat about Indigenous toys. So I tried to get that one on last week, but I messed it up. So we'll do that this week. All right. Anything else, Sean, before we go to
Oh, no. I'm good, Doug.
All right. Chat with you in a bit.
All right.
Shallow of lies we blame.
Well, here I am, summertime, and it's a beautiful sight, and I'm with Dr. Kristen Buckley. And Kristen, you know, we were wondering about food, and, you know, I'm surrounded by farmland and gardens, and I'm here at your center. Tell me, first of all, the name of your center and what you can do here.
Well, this place is called Scenic Splendor, and it is a nature and recreation center. So I rent it out to folks who just need a place to gather, small groups usually. It's just a beautiful space. There's no power lines. There's no buildings in the way. It's just a field and trees and flowers and lots of butterflies out there right now. So people can gather for birthday parties, anniversaries, family reunions. There's activities for the kids. I ran a summer camp here a couple of years ago, so lots of supplies here for kids to keep them entertained. And it's just a beautiful space in nature that I'd like to share with people to de-stress and gather and enjoy.
You have places for them to walk, field and next to the trees?
Yeah, there's a walking path that goes around by the tree line. And then just a field and a little mini putthole that we've started. I'm trying to expand that next. Just a little activity to do here. And yeah, it's just a beautiful space to enjoy in the winter and in summer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've taken a trip with your boys all over the yard when there was snow up to my knees. Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, some snowshoeing.
Maybe that'll be next winter's activity for everybody.
Yeah, maybe.
And also you ran with a friend or an accomplice, Poetry in the Meadow. And so I'm just wondering, will that happen again? Because the poetry from that day, you were really excited about it.
Yeah, actually, I think she's planning on hosting again here in September or October. So that's Dr. Barbara Lang, and she's a poet in Kingston. She does hold poetry sessions sort of all around in different spaces. Her company, I believe it's called Picnics and Pencils, and it's just writing and poetry in beautiful spaces. So she will be back again in the fall. Mm. So we'll be hosting that. And I know that group really enjoyed it here, just the nice and peace and quiet. Lots of things to inspire poetry and lots of just quietness to think and reflect.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, I wouldn't call it a garden, but it's certainly a wild area that mm-hmm. you have. Sort of set up there, and that's where the butterflies have been going in and out, and I saw two birds there earlier, mm-hmm. so I think this is a relaxing spot.
Yeah.
So now we're going to go into our series that mm-hmm. we've been talking about food insecurity in communities, and the focus here at Aboriginal Voices at CFRC is looking at food insecurity in rural and remote areas. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've ever been in remote areas and talk with people there, but certainly you've had a lot of experience in rural areas, not just here in Canada, but in other places. Mm-hmm. You might talk about those too later. But we're going to focus right now. Sort of the stimulus started with the Canada Food Guide. Did you get to see that one?
Yeah, I took a look at that one. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the Canada Food Guide, not only in English and French, but it's in many languages. Mm-hmm. And because it is a new food guide that people should look at, and go to canada.ca/foodguide and you'll end up with the right spot. But then you have to look around a little bit and you can see that you can change languages.
Okay.
So I've looked at Mohawk language, the Haudenosaunee language, mm-hmm. Mohawk and Cayuga. I've also looked at the Ojibwe languages and the Anishinaabe language that is in there, Cree and then Western Canada and Eastern Canada as well. But until recently, I hadn't looked into the far north, you know, the Nunavut or Northern Quebec or Northern Northwest Territories. So we're going to try and focus today maybe on just the rural settings for food insecurity. And it just, to me, it seems like it's not something that people would think about really in a rural setting because, like around here, farms and a lot of people, even in small acreages, still have gardens.
Mm-hmm.
So what can you tell me about food insecurity first? What do you think about it?
I don't know, it's a tough question. I think, you know, a lot of time it's just thinking that there's not enough food available for the people that need it, but sometimes it's about not having the money to buy enough food, right? Which is very relevant today with the prices of food in stores and necessities like gas and heating bills and water bills and things like that. So it becomes less about the availability of food and more about the access to food. So I think my own definition over the years has changed when I hear that term.
Mm-hmm. Should we be changing the term from food insecurity to food security? Or is there another phrase that comes to mind as we're talking through this today? You might say, oh, I've got an idea for you.
Yeah, I'll think about that one. I really like vocabulary, and so I'll be thinking about that for sure, because I think there's something that's maybe more fitting.
Mm-hmm. I'm hoping so.
Yeah.
So let's talk about it. You grew up with a garden at your house, mm-hmm. and then with your grandmother and your mother and your father all helping to take the food from the garden to the table.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping we're going to have listeners send in recipes for some of those foods.
Right.
And what do you do for having the same type of foods, nutritious foods, for winter?
Mm-hmm.
So let's start with the garden.
Yeah, so both sides of my family were farmers. So I had one grandmother that canned everything. I mean, she even canned meat. And when we ended up cleaning out the house, I mean, it was just several truckloads of jars that were taken away. So no one in the family has done canning the way that she did it since then, but it's something that my brothers and I have thought about. My mom does preserve some things, jams and pickles. The other side of the family also had dairy cows and have had lots of gardens. So it still produces lots of corn, lots of garlic. And so we're finding new ways to sort of preserve some of those things. So I think, you know, back a few generations, there were things like root cellars, and they weren't always in the homes. So we have a root cellar that's under the stairs in the basement, but there was a cave that went deep down into the ground, and, you know, a door was put on it, and food was preserved in there. So we're still experimenting different ways to preserve food. So with the garlics, you know, we're dehydrating it now, grinding it into a powder, chopping it and dicing up really small and freezing it in ice cube trays, and then, you know, putting those in Ziploc bags in the freezer. So those were not part of the process way back a few generations, but we're still finding ways to preserve the foods that we're growing on our land.
Okay, so let's just take the garlic for a second, and then what would the process be for that? Did you have to, right from when you get the garlic in the bulb, you know, you peel them off and you get the little...
Yeah, so the bulbs, they have to spend quite a bit of time drying, usually, and then we can just kind of store them in the root cellar. But we've been taking, I'm not sure what it's called, but the spirally part, of the top. I don't think, me when it's growing, that's what we've been experimenting to with dicing up. We've started barbecuing them, to be honest. All kinds of different things. Or it's just like, it's kind of like the new potato. How many different ways can you cook garlic? But then also, taking sort of the different pieces out and dehydrating it or drying it, grinding it. Like,
do you have a dehydrator?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. It gets dehydrated in the garage, not in the house, because you don't want the house to smell like garlic.
So is this a big, costly device to dehydrate things? Or
no, it's just a little one you can pick up from, I think I got mine from Canadian Tire. So it's a fair number of batches. It's a commitment to do it, but it's sure worth it when you can, you know, you're cooking and suddenly you decide you want to throw some garlic in your recipe. You don't have to run out to a grocery store. You can just go to your storage unit.
Mm-hmm. Or go to your freezer.
Yeah, wherever you have it stored. Yeah.
So you can either get freshly squeezed garlic or freshly chopped up garlic.
Yeah.
Okay. And then storing it, it requires a freezer. So if you're a family that doesn't have a freezer, then you're going to have to just stick to the dehydrated and...
Yeah, or you can dry the bulbs as well. So, you know, they only last so long, but you can do it that way. Or if you want it to last longer, then you can dehydrate it or grind it into powder.
That's good. Now, so that's a really great idea. That's just for garlic, mm-hmm. but you can use your dehydrator for other roots, vegetables, or
other produce. It's great for herbs as well. So parsley and dill are another great way to dry those and have those all winter long. I also like to dehydrate strawberries. That's my favorite. I think I've mentioned that one before, but it tastes just like candy. I mean, it's so delicious. So I highly recommend dehydrating strawberries.
How do you do that? So people know how to do that. So you get the strawberries, pick them right away and out of your patch. Then what do you do?
So, well, wash them, of course, and then I slice them less than a quarter of an inch thick. And just lay them out on the dehydrator. I think it takes maybe 5 hours to dehydrate. And again, it's a process because you can only do a batch of so much. And then once it's dry, I tend to put them in mason jars and throw them up in the cupboard. And it's been great just on car rides or camping trips to grab a jar and throw it in the truck.
How do you know they're ready to put in so they don't go bad in the mason jar? So when they're in the dehydrator, do you test them or?
Yeah, I think for me, it's just there's no moisture left in it. Like when you pick it up and you want to sample one or squeeze one, you're going to see some juice in it. You should probably do it more, unless you're going to eat them somewhat soon. So I did dehydrate tangerines once, and those take a really long time because they're a lot thicker. So there was some juice left in the middle, but I took them on, it was just a little road trip, and so we bit into them and enjoyed the juice. That's not something that you could store in your cupboard for a long time, but it lasts longer than a fresh, you know, tangerine that you've left, you know, peeled on your counter, right? Mm-hmm. So it does preserve it a little bit longer, but it's kind of personal preference and doing your own sort of observations of it. So if there is more moisture in it, you're going to eat them sooner than later, I guess.
So you don't put sugar on them or anything?
No,
like
I
that.
Don't.
Okay,
no.
It's just the natural.
Yeah, and apples are really great to dehydrate too.
So
with
strawberries,
the skins on.
Apples.
Yeah.
The peaches?
I haven't done those yet. I have done bananas. Mm-hmm. Those take a long time as well.
So but are these banana chips that you see?
Yeah, banana chips.
First? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That could be costly because, you know, buying them at the store and bringing them in as opposed to growing them.
Yeah.
Or neighbors growing them and you get some.
Right.
Trade-off.
So things like strawberries here in Ontario, we get those usually in June. And then, what was the other thing I said? Apples. Yeah, so apples are something that's readily available. A lot of, like, our farmland, we don't and purposely grow apples, but there's lots of apple trees here. Yeah, so,
well, because the farmland where we are north of Kingston goes back into the early to mid 1800s when they started farming, and you know, people would put in different varieties of apple trees on their property.
Yeah,
mostly for the cattle to eat.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
But you know The people who started farming in the 1800s wouldn't be able to go to the store to buy apples. Mm-hmm. They would have to get the ones they have. So
yeah.
I've seen Cortland apple in our little area near Inverary.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it tasted Cortland apples, McIntosh apple, snow apple. Forget the snow. But I mean, they're small and they're work intensive to get the peeling off. And there were Spartan apples and Northern Spy apples, but I haven't seen any around in the last 3 or 4 years. But
yeah, I don't know my apple species very well, but we do have some really large ones here on the farm, and we have some yellow ones on these paths around this nature center. So sometimes when we're walking around and we don't have water with us, the kids get thirsty, we go and pick an apple.
Yeah.
So they're pretty tasty and they're good.
Yeah. Like, we definitely have to change the title from food insecurity to food security or something. Yeah, something with that in mind.
Yeah.
We're counting on you later on in August to help us with this, change the title.
Yeah.
Listeners might want to toss in an idea or two. Mm-hmm. But certainly when you talk about food and availability and quality and that sort of thing, We also are in this day and age, in 2026 and beyond, the cost of transportation of those fruits that we're talking about, or some of the other produce we're going to be talking about. So that adds to the cost of the food.
Yeah.
Which limits how much you can buy. Right. Okay, what else do you grow in the garden or you had over the years?
Well, I've grown tomatoes quite a few times. I feel like I have a bit of a green thumb for tomatoes.
Oh, wait a sec. For green tomatoes?
And with that, I ended up making salsa one year. And so one of my advice to friends who have just started growing gardens, they'll plant some tomatoes and a few different things, and they'll say, I don't know what else to plant, but I have more space in my garden. And I said, I encourage them to find a recipe and then plant the vegetables that they can use in that recipe. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was salsa. So I had tomatoes and I had different types of peppers and I had onions. And I don't think I grew, I think I tried to grow cilantro. I don't think it, I was successful, but you know, plant the things that when you harvest it, you have a recipe. If you want it to be a salad, do that. If you like cooking beans, plant beans, you know, just, I would say plant what you want to eat. You know, some people just find seeds and think, well, I should grow this and I should grow that. Well, don't, if you don't like it, you know, if you don't, cause the point is to harvest it and eat it. So having a recipe in mind, I think, is a good idea.
Right. So you've got a challenge for your garden. This stretch of garden is going to be my salsa garden.
Yeah.
And another one for would be support a stew.
Exactly.
Know, where you would have, you know, roots like carrots and onions.
Yep.
And I don't know if you'd have potatoes growing or not. But I don't know very many people in this area grow potatoes, but I know Beaton, Alliston, you know.
We grow lots of potatoes here. We have two potato gardens.
Oh.
And same with my uncle's property, lots of potatoes. So I guess that's one of the things that you, like, you can cook many different ways, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a great one. And they store really well. It's having them dry, having the dirt shaken off them, dried, and not out in the sun for too long, although turn green.
Yeah.
And then just storing them in somewhere dry and cool all winter. So we have potato bins.
Oh, is that right?
Yep.
And you don't put them in sand or anything, or just all the potatoes just go in a bin? And
we have a three big wooden bins that they get dumped in, and in the root cellar, and they just stay there all winter. And you can sort them by size too, so you can have ones with small potatoes, ones with bins. So when you go, depending on what you want to cook, you can go find your big potatoes, or you can have a whole pot full of small potatoes.
Activities for kids.
Yeah, there sort the potatoes.
Sort potatoes. Yeah, we'll be back in an hour.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good idea. And the same with onions, can store in bins as well, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And carrots, I've heard over the years carrots are better stored in sand.
That's what I've heard as well, yeah.
Yeah, I don't, how did your parents store theirs?
I think a lot of times they're diced and frozen because we have lots of freezer space.
That's something that I used to have, but my 50-year-old freezer decided not to continue working, and then we were scrambling.
Yeah,
that's the problem with freezers.
Yeah,
right. So you can store it, but I'm only having food security as long as then I have electricity to keep my freezer going, but. Yeah, in the winter it wasn't so much of a problem because we could take some outdoors.
Right.
When it, you know, as long as it was below minus 7 degrees Celsius, but yeah.
I'm trying to bring back the root cellar. So ours is front step, and in the evenings it gets full sun, and so it doesn't work that well in the summer anymore, as you know, cracks start getting in the step and different things, and we kind of have to play around with the moisture, so we have to have a vent and sometimes cover it and sometimes uncover it, so you can get some condensation in there. Sort of got one planned back in the woods, where, you know, it's in the shaded trees and, you know, there's a big deep hole there and maybe fresh layer of brick. So working on making a new purposeful root cellar that has better conditions for storing food.
Mm. Have you ever traveled to Newfoundland?
I have not.
Oh, the Bonavista Peninsula. You would love going there to a little town of Elliston,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, where all the root cellar openings are stone walls going into what would be a cave.
Right.
And a little door and so on, and people have used them for many, many years.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, check that out. You know, even you can go virtually to see Elliston.
Right, okay.
Yeah. So we have all the garden, you know, you plant, you said corn as well. I don't know mm-hmm. how you store your corn. A lot of people store the corn in, you know, they process it and freeze it or process it and put it in jars. Mm-hmm. Do you have any stories related to corn?
Yeah, that was a big one for our family all the time. So it was, you know, cooking it and cutting all the kernels off the cobs and putting them in baggies. And I wrote a short story about it once, which I believe we shared on here, but it was definitely a family process of picking and the kids husking and the grown-ups boiling the corn and cutting it off, and then the kids again their turn is spooning it into the bags, and you always have to put a label of the year on it because it's good to eat it within a certain time period, right? So if some's left over till the next year, you don't want to get them mixed up, so there's always a year written on the bag. So yeah, that's still happens, but on a very small scale these days. Mm-hmm. Before it was feeding, you know, two or three families of, you know, five, and now it's really just, you know, one family of five that we're feeding. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah.
Have you ever dehydrated corn so you could make cornmeal?
I have not done that. No.
Okay, that's something else that I'm going to be looking into. So that'll be one question.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I love cornmeal muffins. So that might be a motivation for me to try that.
Mm-hmm. And I know cornmeal biscuits or cornmeal scones,
mm-hmm.
you know, they're good too. Along with my favorite, peach jam.
Okay.
Yeah. Making jams are another way of preserving some of the things, but they take a lot of sugar.
Yes.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I have to cut back on sugar these days, so
okay.
I don't have as many jars of peach jam.
Right.
Yeah. But we used to do, I mean, we used to go and get strawberries, raspberries, cherries, mm-hmm. Peaches, pears, just at the neighbor farms around where I grew up.
Yeah, canned, jarred peaches is still mm-hmm. a thing as well. I bought some, there's a store in Newburgh called, I think, Harvest Fresh. And there's an Amish group that supplies a lot of their jarred fruits. And I think they have all kinds of things. But I saw this giant jar of peaches, and I couldn't help but buy them. And they tasted just like fresh peaches.
Mm.
It was great. So there's a lot of canned or jarred fruits and vegetables in that store, which is nice to have that as an option. You know, it's a little bit of a drive for us here, but worth it.
Newburgh is just around Westport area, or is that the one north of Napanee?
Yeah, it's sort of north of Napanee. Yeah.
Okay. One of our trips, I think we can do a field trip.
Okay.
Yeah, head out to do that. Yeah, and plus, I was thinking as you were talking about that, the peach syrup that go, you know, when you do the peaches, like to go in the, you know, the quart jars mm-hmm. that we had as young people. The syrup recipe we learned, you know, you would add some and do it. We had a whole series of how much sugar went into the syrup. And,
right.
And 1 year we did it with maple syrup mm-hmm. rather than with a lot of sugar.
Right.
And that really worked well.
Oh, good.
Yeah, which surprised me too.
Yeah.
But the peaches were not as flavorful as a peach because mm-hmm. it did have this maple taste in it.
Yeah.
You have to like maple syrup to do it.
Right. Well, our family has been making syrup for, I think, 109 years now. So mm-hmm. I tend to put syrup in a lot of my recipes. I don't even buy white sugar anymore. But you do have to be prepared that it does alter the mm-hmm. flavor. So I put a spoonful of maple syrup in my coffee every morning. And it took me some gradual amount of time before that became the flavor I was used to. But that's what I do all the time now. So it's a good alternative.
Good alternative. So you've taken me from the garden to the table to preserving. Mm-hmm. And is there anything else you would like to add into that right now before we go to some music?
Well, I've been thinking about the term, and, okay. You know, accessibility is sort of what we're talking about. And I do think there is accessibility to local food. So, you know, when the apples come on the tree, there's a lot of apples, and there's almost too many apples for people. And so I think timing it is really important. Like, if we could have a community event, like, yes, there's apple picking, but there's still a cost to that. If there was a community event that was, okay, we've sold as many apples as we can, and now there's just excess and they're going to spoil, now's the time for people who want to come and gather to gather. You know, if there was more of that sort of when it's available, mm-hmm. and when it's an excess, if that was, if that knowledge was available to people and there was an opportunity to say, come get our excess. Because our garden, we grow too much in our garden sometimes as well. And you try to give it away, but maybe the people who could really use it aren't aware of that, right? So right. I think some more programs like that, that kind of really take advantage of when the food is available, because that's important for local, right. locally grown food.
And the food banks are getting larger and larger right now. But mm-hmm. in a rural setting, the food bank is your neighbor.
Sometimes, yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah,
and, but this is a great idea. So there must be in various communities, you know, like church groups or mm-hmm. or service groups like Lions and Rotary and
yeah.
And there are other groups like that. And, you know, that you've given us a lot to think about now, mm-hmm. Kristen, and thank you very much for this, because you're going to send me out now. I know I've got two places to go from your conversation today, so I'm going to be looking at that. And, you know, we'll just see. If listeners want to comment, which we've been getting them when we talk with you in our conversations, which is really nice. Conversations with Kristen have led to a number of people suggesting different directions for us to talk about items, and you're continuing that. So if people want to comment on it, aboriginalvoices@cfrc.ca. That's all one word, lowercase, aboriginalvoices@cfrc.ca, and that's our email.
Mm-hmm.
Good. And Tuesday nights, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., you never know when it's going to be on. There's not a scheduled time. This is your time. Although we might have to, because I know that people are asking when.
Right.
And when you're going to next be on. So, great. Thank you very much, Kristen. Okay. Last word to you.
Well, just thank you for having me. It's fun to have these conversations.
You're so welcome.
Again. Respect the gift. You gotta give it all you got.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Our mission today is pretty laser focused on early childhood education.
It is.
But we're looking specifically at the profound role of play, especially when it's intentionally grounded in cultural heritage and, you know, identity.
That's right. We've been diving into a really detailed resource that champions the integration of Indigenous toys and other learning materials into early learning environments.
Right, particularly in the Canadian context.
Exactly. And what's great is that this source moves beyond just theory. It actually shows concrete visual examples of how this is all implemented.
So we're here to get a quick grasp of the cultural, the developmental, and I think especially the long-term societal importance of doing this. And the big picture takeaway seems to be this. Integrating these materials isn't just about checking a box for diversity.
Not at all. The sources position this as a powerful, active step toward truth and reconciliation, and also toward fostering holistic development for all children, not just some.
All children, regardless of their background.
Right. The whole premise is that the foundation of a child's identity, their sense of belonging, their cultural understanding, all of that is set really early.
And it's built through the stories they hear and the physical things they engage with every single day.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's unpack this then. If you're a teacher or a parent, you look at, say, a hand puppet or a counting game, and you just see a toy.
Sure.
What is it about infusing it with Indigenous knowledge that transforms it into this profound catalyst for cultural identity and genuine connection?
Well, to really appreciate the power of these resources, I think we have to acknowledge the historical context. That's what makes this integration so critical today.
Okay.
Indigenous peoples are the original caretakers of these lands.
Yeah.
But we just can't ignore the decades, really centuries, of cultural destruction that came with colonization.
And the sources are very clear that the tragedy of the residential school system was fundamentally an attempt at cultural erasure.
A deliberate one.
And that systemic inequities continue to impact Indigenous communities today.
Precisely.
Mm-hmm.
So the goal of this pedagogical shift is really about repairing some of that damage by actively supporting cultural revitalization and equity.
So it's an action.
It is. The sources argue that by recognizing and fully integrating Indigenous culture in that ECE space, we're not just teaching history, we are contributing to the ongoing strength and presence of these cultures. It's an act of affirmation.
That affirmation brings us to this concept that really feels like the central pillar of the sources, the idea of mirrors and windows.
It's a beautifully simple and, I think, really powerful framework. For Indigenous children, culturally grounded materials act as mirrors.
Mirrors.
They reflect traditional symbols, languages, art, storytelling. And when a child sees their own culture validated and affirmed in the toys they play with, it just supports their identity. It validates their experiences.
It must nurture their self-worth and their sense of belonging.
It fundamentally does. It helps them internalize this idea that they are seen, that they are valued and respected in that learning environment.
Okay, so that's the mirror. And then for non-Indigenous children, these same things act as windows.
Exactly. They open up authentic, meaningful opportunities to learn about and appreciate the richness of Canada's diverse Indigenous cultures.
And this moves the learning beyond just, you know, abstract concepts.
It does. It encourages real curiosity and promotes a deep empathy that can build that cross-cultural respect from a very young age.
We can see this in practice with some of the examples they show, like the balancing or stacking game.
Oh, yeah. That one's great. It features these traditional animal figures and designs, and it requires focus, fine motor skills.
A core developmental skill.
A core developmental skill. But the design itself celebrates traditional knowledge at the same time. It's just seamlessly integrated.
I think that's the key distinction, right? The sources highlight that this isn't tokenism. It's not just putting a symbol on a block.
Wow.
It's embedding cultural affirmation into the core mechanics of play. Look at the puzzles with indigenous syllabics paired with traditional art. You're not just learning to fit pieces together.
You're normalizing and celebrating language and artistic heritage while you build dexterity. That normalization is such a critical educational outcome.
So, moving beyond identity then, let's clarify what defines these resources.
Well, Indigenous learning materials are intentionally designed with cultural teachings, traditional stories, nature-based elements, and language preservation right at their foundation. They reflect Indigenous ways of knowing and being,
which often emphasize interconnectedness.
That's the key, interconnectedness.
And here's where it gets really insightful when you compare it to more conventional ECE models.
Mm-hmm.
This focus on interconnectedness leads directly to this idea of holistic education. You know, many standard tools segment knowledge. Here's the math corner. Here's the reading corner.
They're siloed.
But Indigenous tools nurture the whole child mind, body, and spirit.
That's a really important distinction. The resources show that this holistic approach ensures that play naturally weaves together cognitive development, emotional connection, and, crucially, environmental understanding.
So the skills aren't isolated. They're learned within a web of relationships.
And those relationships, above all, connect the child to the land. This is the very definition of land-based learning and stewardship.
The source points out that many traditional toys are crafted from organic or locally sourced materials. Materials like wood, stone, fur, or shell.
Yes, and the materials themselves carry knowledge. So by engaging with these natural elements, children learn firsthand about the seasons, the local ecosystem, animal life, and the philosophy of stewardship.
So it's more than just a hands-on activity.
Much more. It's fostering a deep, respectful relationship with the environment, which in turn reinforces cognitive development and an understanding of sustainability.
And we get a really tangible sense of this through the sensory bins that are detailed in the sources.
Oh, those are fantastic examples.
They show how you can curate these little environments to share specific Indigenous knowledge.
Right. One bin provides this rich Arctic environment.
Yeah.
It has small white and gray rocks, an igloo model, and the children's book, The Three Hunters.
So right away, the play is anchored to a specific geography.
Exactly. It demands that the child think about survival, about climate, and about the stories connected to that specific landscape.
And the other example is just as rich, a forest theme.
Yeah, that bin is filled with all these tactile natural elements, logs, ferns, pine cones, little wooden bridge.
And books like Sharing Our World.
Yeah.
Animals of the Northwest Coast.
And by interacting with, you know, the roughness of the bark or the texture of the pine cones, children are developing sensory skills while learning the names and roles of local animals. It's all happening at once.
This sensory and land-based interaction connects directly to language and oral tradition, which is our next area.
A huge area. The sources stress that language revitalization is a vital act of cultural preservation for future generations.
And they specifically mention traditional languages being supported through play, languages like Cree, Ojibwe, and Inuktitut. But how does play actually achieve such a monumental task?
Well, play normalizes the language. It's as simple as that. When a child hears and uses ancestral languages during just everyday activities,
yeah,
like a counting game or a puppet show,
mm-hmm,
it reinforces their cultural identity in this low-stakes, joyful environment. It takes a marginalized language and puts it right at the center of learning.
I think this is where the deep dive element really comes into focus. The sources include this seemingly small, but I think crucial, noted disclaimer about the complexity of these languages.
Oh, yes. The dialects.
The various dialects. Why is that specific detail so important to mention in a resource that's about toys?
That detail is absolutely critical. It shows genuine respect for localization and cultural protocol. Languages like Cree are not monolithic. They have distinct dialects spoken across vast regions.
Okay, that makes sense.
So by acknowledging this, the resource is ensuring that educators aren't just using some standardized version that might not be locally accurate. It's an insistence that curriculum and materials have to be guided by local elders and knowledge keepers.
Honoring the specific teachings of that community.
Exactly. The design principle is inherently local and respectful, not standardized.
And this approach also extends to literacy. We see examples of bookshelves filled with titles that embed traditional language words like Awasis and the world-famous Bannock.
Or It's a metique. Reading these titles just brings the language into the daily narrative, into the daily rhythm of reading.
And that integration then just flows into storytelling itself. The source emphasizes how these materials naturally encourage imaginative and non-prescriptive play.
They don't come with rigid instructions.
Right. They invite the child to invent, to build, to narrate their own stories, which aligns perfectly with the oral tradition in so many indigenous knowledge systems.
It nurtures cognitive flexibility.
The visual example of the hand puppets really drives this home. They're based on animal totems, the octopus, the bear, the fox.
Animals that hold deep significance in various teachings. They aren't just figures, they are narrative catalysts.
And they're displayed next to a sign with this simple, open-ended question, can you tell an animal story?
And that prompt right there, that connects cultural teachings directly to creative narration. It fosters literacy and emotional expression all at the same time.
So these non-prescriptive tools, whether it's miniature canoes for water play or felt storytelling pieces, they're really rich instruments that expand a child's worldview.
And strengthen their ability to communicate complex ideas.
Okay, moving to our final segment. Let's talk about community connection. Because this isn't just happening in a vacuum. This integration seems to transform the learning space from just a classroom into a hub.
A hub for intergenerational knowledge transfer, absolutely. The materials themselves act as invitations.
Invitations.
They actively encourage elders, knowledge keepers, and other community members to come into the learning space to share traditional stories, songs, and teachings. This is so crucial for strengthening community ties.
The sources really emphasize that this kind of participation helps children see learning as this shared living experience.
One that honors the wisdom of generations past.
It builds bridges between the children and their wider community, which provides that vital sense of belonging and cultural continuity that has been, you know, historically fragmented.
And for Indigenous families, this is where identity and pride can really flourish. For non-Indigenous families, it cultivates authentic, informed relationships rooted in respect.
In reconciliation, it creates a truly inclusive educational environment for everyone.
That's the goal.
So if you're an educator or a program planner, how do you even measure the success of integrating these approaches? What does this all mean for the developmental checklist?
The sources provide a really wonderful synthesis of that, showing the comprehensive, holistic impact of this practice.
Okay, let's break it down.
We can do it quickly, but it's powerful. In the social-emotional area, this play fosters deep empathy, resilience, inclusion, and a really robust sense of identity. Resilience isn't just a word on a report card, right?
Right.
It's the outcome of having a validated, strong self-concept from a young age.
Cognitively, it elevates abilities like problem-solving and critical thinking through those open-ended stories, all while building deep cultural knowledge.
Language and literacy are dramatically enhanced through exposure to ancestral languages and the rich oral tradition we've been talking about.
And finally, fine motor skills get engaged by interacting with all those handcrafted, tactile materials, and environmental stewardship is just naturally embedded.
It hits every single developmental pillar. The clear goal for the future, according to these sources, is equity.
Right.
Integrating these culturally responsive resources really lays the foundation for a more inclusive, just, and respectful society. A society where differences aren't just tolerated or accepted.
But genuinely celebrated as strengths. It's a transformative practice. Play based on Indigenous materials acts as this powerful tool for reconciliation, for identity formation, and for comprehensive holistic learning.
All grounded in a deep respect for the land and for community wisdom.
It really is.
The sources show us a direct, almost undeniable link between seeing yourself reflected in the tools and stories of your childhood and, well, your growth trajectory. So if knowledge is most valuable when it's understood and applied, consider this. How does seeing yourself reflected in the stories and tools of your childhood fundamentally shift your relationship with learning, with confidence, and with the world around you?
Something powerful to consider as you reflect on this deep dive.
With my back to the wall, all I'm doing now
Its triumphant return to CFRC.
Green scales are golden once more.
Tune in on Sunday, August 30th at 6:45 p.m. to catch all the action that makes you stand up and say... most exhilarating sports broadcast.
And it's picked off, picked off, picked off.
This is Canada's gold standard of football action.
The Gales stop the Griffins short.
This is Gales game day.
Running hard, breaking away, touchdown Queens.
And it can only be found on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Are you looking for smoking hot local singles in your area? Well, look no further. Tune in Thursdays at 11:30 for the Release Radar Rundown with great singles released by local Kingston artists, a program made possible in partnership with the Kingston Music Office and our friends at Modern City Taxi. We've got something for everyone with great music across genres made by musicians in our community. Join in the fun. Release Radar Rundown, Thursdays, 11:30 a.m., right